go to 1 Samuel 17 once again, and we should complete the chapter tonight. 1 Samuel chapter 17. And we'll break it down into three parts. 1, verses 31 through 40, David volunteers. Verse 31, when the words of David spoke were heard, they told them to Saul, and he sent for them. And in this context, David is going to volunteer to go forth and fight Goliath. With verse 40, the last part of it, you have the concluding five words of verse 40, and he approached the Philistine. And so in 41 through 44, David now confronts. Then you come down to verse 45, and David said to the Philistine, "You come to me with a sword, a spear, and a javelin, but I come to you in the name of the Lord of hosts." And we have in this section, David conquers. So, three broad brushstrokes. First, he is volunteering to do the fighting. He then, 41 through 44, confronts Goliath, the Philistine, and then he finally, 45 on, conquers. So let's begin then with our first point, and he is going to volunteer to go forth into battle and to meet Goliath, and that's in 31 through 40, and we start out with his act of volunteering, and that is 31 through 33. Reading. When the words which David spoke were heard, they told them to Saul, and he sent for him. And David said to Saul, "Let no man's heart fail on account of him. Your servant will go and fight with the Philistine." And so in this context, he volunteers, and Saul responds and says to David, "You are not able to go against this Philistine to fight with him, for you are but a youth, while he has been a warrior from his youth." Now, several things. First of all, his act. And that is to express what is the mood of David when he volunteers. What is he feeling? Well, I think we can find out what he's feeling by going back to verse 26. David spoke to the men who were standing by him, saying, "What will be done for the man who kills this Philistine, takes away the reproach from Israel?" And I take it the next sentence tells his mood. It tells how he's feeling. "For who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should taunt the armies of the living God?" His mood is David arrives on the battlefront and he is appalled at what he sees. He arrives just at the time that Goliath comes forth. He looks at the whole scene. He sees what the army of Israel is doing. He sees what the Philistine is doing. And he is literally appalled. And he's saying, "Who in the world is this man that he should do this to us?" And so I think 16:26 very clearly gives the mood or the emotional setting for that. And by the way, in the study of Scripture, that's always something to read for. Whenever you read a narrative, ask the author's mood. Is he angry? Is he surprised? Is he confused? Is he amazed? Is he struck with awe? What is his mood? And here David is described as coming up with food for his brothers. He arrives just when Goliath comes forth and challenges them. And he's not so much surprised, he is appalled. Who in the world does this man think he is? He's taunting the armies of the living God, and that is the mood with which he approaches the whole thing. Now, sub-points on the mood. 26. Who is this uncircumcised Philistine? Now, what is the reason for emphasizing uncircumcised Philistine? Well, remember, circumcision was the sign of the people of God. So he was not part of God's people. He's an uncircumcised Philistine. he was not part of God's people. But that goes a little bit further. Not only is he one with no relationship to God, that is, he is an uncircumcised Philistine, but further, that he should taunt the armies of the living God. Not part of God's people, he taunts God's people. And David, in his own mind, is saying, this must stop. It's almost a rebuke to his brothers. None of them had volunteered to fight Goliath. But David sees in this whole situation a completely inappropriate time. It's interesting that David sees it this way. Opposition to Israel is equal to what? Opposition to God. Oppose Israel is to oppose God. That's true throughout the Old Testament. Now, the only support that anybody offers David, and you would thought after 40 days of being challenged that the armies would say, well, at last, somebody is going to hang in there for Yahweh. And you would have thought that his three brothers would have said, wow, we are so proud to have our brother go into battle. We really support you, David. But you know, David only gets one line of support from the whole crew, and that's down in chapter 17, verse 37. Notice the last sentence. David says, or Saul says to David, go and may the Lord be with you. And so all that he gets in terms of support, no family support, no military support, no idea that David, we're praying for you, David, we're pulling for you, David will back you up. It's just a remark from Saul that, well, it's suicide and he's going to wipe you out, but David, may God be with you. So all he gets is sort of a feeble, God bless you, and that's the total support that he has. Now, his support system, however, came in his mental attitude. And we'll find out how that worked in the following context. So notice, he now, along with the mood, makes an offer. And he makes an offer to fight. And while that is in the following verse, it's interesting to note two things. Number one, notice in verse 32, David addresses the primary issue. Because the primary issue was not the strength of the Philistine. The primary issue in any battle that a believer or anyone else ever goes into is mental attitude. And notice that's the first thing on his lips. Verse 32, David said to Saul, let no man's heart fail on account of him. And therefore, primary issue for you, Saul, for the armies, and for me, primary issue, mental attitude. And if we're going to go into this thing fearing the Philistines, if you do, Saul, if the armies do, and if I do, we're not starting with what is primary. Get your head together first. And that's exactly what he's saying in verse 32. Now, if you have your mental attitude together, then all you have to do is sit back and relax and watch God do all the rest. Is that true? We'll look at the second half of the verse. Let no man's heart fail on account of him. Don't be afraid. Mental attitude. But mental attitude has to be followed by action. And the action is, 32, your servant will go and fight with this Philistine. So notice in the logic of this section is this. Trust in God does not eliminate action. Trust is not passivity. And therefore, I'm going to do two things. Number one, I'm going to have it together mentally, but I'm going to recognize you cannot fear, You can trust and trust and trust and trust, but if you keep your stone in the sling, no battle is won. Now, we're going to see this a couple of times coming up, and I think many, many, many times Christians go between two irrational poles. Have you ever heard it said that the only hands that God has are your hands? And that's the crowd that feels like you've got to do it all or nothing will happen. On the other hand, have you seen the crowd that says, well, we'll sit in our rocking chair and do nothing and leave it all in the hands of God? Which side is right? Neither. Both are wrong. And in the first half of verse 32, he's saying, trust the Lord. And in verse 32, the second half, he's saying, I'll go and fight. Trust and fight. Trust and fight. There are the two words. Trust and fight are not enemies. Trust and fight are not antonyms. They are both there. It's like the little remark, if you're out in the middle of a thunderstorm in a little boat and it's threatening to go down, what do you do? Trust God and row like hell. And that is a balance between these two. That trust is not, and he's all ready to fight, all ready to go to battle, but trust is there at the same time. Remember, much, much Christian truth hinges on one word, balance. And every time I hear that, I will never forget the most memorable words I ever heard in seminary. Charles Ryrie, men, the most biggest test of your ministry is balance. Knowing that God is to be trusted, but you're to fight a battle. Knowing that the Holy Spirit uses the Word of God and yet you urge it on people with passion. And that is a very, very, very important concept and it's coming up in this particular context. Now, when you go down to verse 33, check out the logic. Is Saul illogical or does it make a lot of sense? Saul said to David, you're not able to go against this Philistine to fight with him for your but a youth, while this man has been a warrior from your age. In other words, his experience is much more than yours. Now, there is a feature that enters into the picture, and it will be the thing that is observed by the enemies of David and by his friends. Do you know what it is? One thing is mentioned four times. And in these four times, it's always mentioned first. What do you think as you were Saul? And David comes in and offers to fight the battle. What did you see first? What grabbed your attention more than anything else? When he faces Goliath, what grabbed Goliath's attention before anything else grabbed his attention? And when Abner, after the battle, what is it that you saw in David that was always the very first thing you noticed? Well, I'll give you the Hebrew word, and I'm going to give you the Hebrew word simply because in this context it's used four times but not translated the same. The word is na'ar, N-A-A-R. And I'm giving you this word simply because I want you to see it and you'll miss it in the English text. It's the first thing that Saul saw. Verse 33. And Saul said to David, you are not able to go against this Philistine to fight with him, for you are but a na'ar. Translation in 1733 is you are just a youth. Now, when we talk about his being a youth, you would naturally wonder just how young was he? Well, let me give you a usage of the word. Exodus chapter 3, I believe it is. Exodus 3, And I believe it is verse 2. No, it is not. Try 2, 3. Try, yes, 2, 3. 2, 3. How young can a Na'ar be? And when you think of youth, do you think this far back? When you think of youth, just in your own mind now, what locks in your mind with youth? Is a two-year-old a youth? A one-year-old a youth? Is a baby a youth? Is a newborn a youth? Don't we tend in our own use of that word youth to kind of push it up a little bit? Young people, 12, 13, 14. Well, notice in this context what a Na'ar is called. The woman conceived and bore a son. When she saw that he was beautiful, she hid him for 3 months. And when she could hide him no longer, she got him a wicker basket and covered it with tar and pitch. Then she put the child, Na'ar, into it. So we know that a Na'ar can go back as far as a little baby in a basket, wicker basket. We have other, and here it would be 3-month-old child. You think of a 3-year-old as a youth? Well, to get the flavor of the Hebrew word, we ought to. It's even used of a just-born child. And our translation is youth. So we ought to broaden out our minds and recognize that youth is not a teenager necessarily. The word can work, reach all the way back to a just-born child. Chapter 17, verse 42. Notice the first thing that Saul said as David walked into that tent. Why, this kid is just a child. And you come down to his meeting with the Philistine. When the Philistine looked and saw David, he disdained him for, what's the first thing he saw? He was but a youth. The young age strikes the Philistine. Verse 42, he is only a youth. And notice in these instances, that's the first impression, was how young he was. Now let me add one other thing, because it's very colorable in the Hebrew, is that as the Philistine looks at him, he says he's a youth and ruddy. And the word ruddy is the word Adam, like Adam. And as you know, Adam means red. And it was often used for the pink cheeks of a little boy. And so Goliath is in a rage. This kid doesn't even have fuzz on his lips. He's got little cute pink cheeks. And it infuriates Goliath, so that coming down to verse 42, he saw David, he disdained him, he was just a child, and he was pink-cheeked, but handsome in appearance. And notice again, the thing that struck him was youth. Chapter 17, verse 55. Now when Saul saw David going out against the Philistines, what's the first thing that he saw as he entered battle? First thing that struck him. Why, this is just a kid. Because he said to Abner, the commander of the army, Abner, whose son is this? Na'ar. And here, in 1755, it is called a young man. Just a young man. Notice, youth is the thing that strikes the mind. 1758. Saul said to him, whose son are you, Na'ar, young man? So, the important thing to note through all of this is this. The first striking feature of David that meets their eye, he is just a child. Now, I know my perspective is changing. But I have been amazed that to getting on an airplane and looking up in the cockpit and finding out that the pilot, from appearances to me, doesn't have his Eagle Scout badge yet. He looks so young, and I want to say, have you shaved yet? Now, maybe that's just my perspective coming from the standpoint of not being a youth anymore. But nonetheless, these men are struck. And they're struck with how very young this man happens to be. And that is the thing that comes forefront in all of this context. So picture a very, we don't know the age, but picture a very, very, very young man. So that when you come to 17, you can't really say that Saul doesn't know what he's talking about. You're not able to go against this Philistine to fight with him. You're too young. He's been a warrior from his youth. And you, David, are simply too young to face the battle. Now, that was not ridicule. That was sincere opinion. And I think we can make an observation off of that. The logic of Saul was not as important as the faith of David. The logic of Saul was not as important as, and the two contrasting words are logic and faith. His logic was not as important as the faith of David. And the entire context will not point out that Saul was stupid, that Saul was illogical, that Saul couldn't make an argument for his inability because of his youth. That's all assumed. But there is something else that enters the context. And that is the mental attitude of David was stronger than Saul ever estimated. Now, notice we're going to have, after his act, Saul comes onto the scene now, and we have first of all his act, and then as Saul says, you're too young to do it, David is going to make his argument. His act, and now his argument. And his argument is in 17, 34 through 37. And when you come down to verse 34, here's his argument. David said to Saul, your servant, referring to himself, was tending his father's sheep when a lion or bear came and took a lamb from his flock. I went out after him, and I attacked him and rescued it from his mouth. And when he rose up against me, I seized him by his beard and struck him and killed him. Your servant has killed both the lion and the bear, and the uncircumcised Philistine will be like one of them, since he has taunted the armies of the living God. So his argument is based on precedent. The thesis is precedent. Let me tell you what I have done before. Now, when we think about precedent, it's very important to recognize that precedent was one of the strongest prayer arguments in the Old Testament. You ever stopped about that? Precedent in Israel was a very strong prayer argument. And it will take various forms. It will say, you delivered Israel over here. You must deliver me here if you're consistent with what you do. You delivered them, you deliver me. Who used that argument? Very powerfully. Look at Psalm 22. And as you recall, Psalm 22 is a prayer of Christ on the cross and records his words beginning with the, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? And so forth. And verse 2, oh my God. But notice the argument that begins in verse 4. And it's argument of precedent. Jesus says, in thee our fathers trusted. History. They trusted. History. And thou didst deliver them. History. To thee they cried out. History. And were delivered. History. In thee they trusted. History. And were not disappointed. History. Or precedent. So what is the argument? The argument is, Lord, you did it for them. You owe it to me. And therefore, even Jesus used the argument of precedent. You've done it previously, and you can and will do it again. Now notice, to an extent, David is basing his plea on precedent. He's simply saying, I have had experience. Now what is there in that experience of David that makes it even more likely that God would help him with the Philistine? Can you see anything there that would distinguish between the lion and the bear and Goliath? Reading 34 down through. And you don't see it till you get to verse 36, I don't believe. Were the lion and the bear attacking God? Was Goliath attacking God? Now do you feel the logic? If the lion and the bear were not attacking God, and you delivered me and I beat them, then don't I expect your help all the more in this man who is not like a lion and is not like a bear, but he wants to attack you? And the last words of verse 36. They're all of verse 36. Your servant has killed the lion and the bear, and the uncircumcised will be like one of them. Period? No, the verse continues. Not period, but comma. Since he, in contrast to the lion and the bear, has taunted the armies of the living God. So his argument then is based on precedent. And therefore, more than in the lion and the bear episode, I can claim God's help. Because here, as over against there, there is a moral issue. And the argument is the lion and the bear attacked sheep. Goliath attacked God. Now, I don't think that Saul understood a word he was saying. And why would I say that? Well, I think we can say that because he tried to palm him off as a soldier, didn't he? And what's the next thing he does in verse 38? Saul clothed David with his garments. I mean, you don't look like a soldier, so we'll dress you like one. And I think you're going to get eaten alive, but let's fake it. Does that go true to character with Saul? He never saw the spiritual issue. He always faked it. So let's dress him up like a soldier. And David must have been a fairly little guy. Because David, and this has to be humorous. Saul clothed David with his garments and put a bronze helmet on his head, clothed with an armor, and David girded his sword over the armor and tried to walk. Have you ever had a little kid in your house and you put on dad's clothes, his boots, and whatever, and maybe he has fire equipment. The little kid dresses up like dad, and his axe is dragging along, and it's a funny picture. And so apparently David gets on these things as this little pink-cheeked guy gets all these things on, and he tries to walk across the room and he falls over the spear or falls over the club or falls over the javelin, and he says, this ain't going to work. So in the context then, notice he goes to that with which he is familiar. Says, I cannot go with these, for I have not tested them, and David took them off. Took his stick. Oh, that is going to tick Goliath off. You little pink-cheeked idiot have come out with a switch. What do you think you're fighting? A pet poodle? And that will be the thrust, and it will get to his ego. So he took his stick in his hand and chose for himself 5 smooth stones from the brook, put them in his shepherd's bag, which he had, even in his pouch, and his sling was in his hand, and he approached the Philistines. Now, we ought to add that accuracy with a sling was a tremendous skill. Keep your finger here and let me show you a note in Judges chapter 20. Judges 20. Some of the shepherds were so good with their sling. They could be so precise with it. That this was noted, and I can think of about 5 places where this is noted, but I pick out simply one of them, Judges 20 and verse 16. Out of all these, well, let's go back to the description of the army. Verse 15, from the cities on that day, the sons of Benjamin were numbered 26,000 men who draw the sword, besides the inhabitants of Gibeah who were numbered 700 choice men. And out of all these people, 700 choice men were left-handed. Each one could sling a stone at a hair and not miss. Now, I'm sure that's a figure of speech, but he's simply saying that going into battle was a special contingency of men, special forces, the sling forces, special forces, the Red Berets or the Green Berets or the Navy SEALs or something. And they were good. And they could hit with that sling. Now, David was doubtless in that category. So let's go back to his armor. And he's now ready in the context to confront. So David now confronts. David confronts. And the confrontation is found in 41 through 44. And notice the approach in verse 41 of Goliath. Then the Philistine came on and approached David with a shield bearer in front of him. Now I think it's interesting to link 2 words here. Goliath comes forward toward David. And what would you tend to do? I would tend to get the stone in there, and what would you do? Here he comes, back off a little bit. Give yourself all the time you can give. But he doesn't. Goliath charges David, and David charged Goliath. I have a line between the words approached David in verse 41 and verse 48. Verse 48 says, then it happened when the Philistine rose and came and drew near to meet David, that David ran quickly toward the battle line or toward him. So the first thing to note in the confrontation is very simply this. 1, Goliath charged David. But David, or and David, charged him. And I think what all of that is saying is David was not only courageous, he was aggressive. He not only was willing to fight, he couldn't wait to fight. And he didn't merely wait to be met and defend himself. His posture was aggressive. Now that would not be unusual in Old Testament military warfare, because they were not out there to hold any line. They weren't out there to hold anything. They were out there to meet the enemy and win over the enemy. And David really personifies the way Israel fought, is that you're not going to charge me. You charge toward me and I'll be on my steed on the way to you. And so he's very aggressive in the context. Now, in verses 42, 43, and 44, we have an outline of what pride did to Goliath. So we have Goliath's mental attitude, and it's good to see it before we come up to David's. Number one, Goliath had been blinded by appearances. Of course, so had Saul, for that matter. But what he saw blinded him. And that's verse 42. When the Philistine looked and he saw David, he disdained him. For he was but a kid. He was pink-cheeked and good-looking. So this good-looking Boy Scout is going to approach him. And so he looks at David's appearance and he begins to get mad. And as he gets mad, we find out that he was blinded by a second thing. He was blinded by pride. When he saw this kid coming toward him, treating him as though he were no enemy, no problem at all, he just boiled. Is there anything more difficult than to be, what's the word for it in Latin, persona non gratis? You know that expression? It means, we don't even look at you. You're not worth anything. I mean, you don't even belong in our class. And David is treated as that in verse 43. Philistine said to David, and notice it's in reaction to what he saw that made him so mad. Am I a dog that you come to take me with sticks? Doesn't that reek with pride? And the Philistine cursed David by his God. So he was blinded by pride. Now we've mentioned that one of the ways that battles were fought in these times was to pick a representative from each side and let them do the fighting between one another. Well, of all the texts that we have of these battles and the ancient Near Eastern texts, there are lots of them. They all have one feature. And it's a feature that, and I haven't seen these things for years. See if you can make the analogy. It's the feature where before you had the fighting match, you had the yelling match. And each opponent would come out and say, I am so strong and you're a squirt. And the other side would say, I am so strong and you're so stupid. What's a good illustration of that? Wrestling matches. These good monsters come out and what do? Half of it is just pure rhetoric. And that's, to me, the only thing about the wrestling match that's really funny, or really a match, is to see these guys both yelling about what they're going to do to the other person. Well, if you can take that and translate it over here, here comes Goliath and he does his wrestling song and dance. I'm going to feed you to the birds. And this type of thing. And we'll see the contrast of his little speech that he makes here and the ones that that follow. So in just a little note here, that the prelude to these kinds of battles, prelude involved two things. One, boasting of your own strength, coupled with scorning the enemy. And that's exactly the way Goliath comes out, and that's the way all these encounters begin, with rhetorical flourish and a lot of talk, just as the wrestling match. So notice his pride comes through in verse 43, and then finally he was blinded by utter arrogance. He was so arrogant. Always remember, there is no objectivity in arrogance. Arrogance can be so obviously whipped and beaten, but arrogance never knows when you're beaten, because you can't be beaten. That's your mental mindset. And since you can't be beaten, you never see the reality. And therefore, verse 44, the Philistine came also, said also to David, "Come to me, and I will give your flesh to the birds of the sky and to the beasts of the field." Lost my place. Beasts of the, where are the beasties here? The field. Okay, the field. Now, what he's saying is, I'm going to make you carrion, and you will not be buried. Now, in our mentality, at least in the West, we figure this. When you kill a man, he's dead. I mean, that's the way it is. I do remember hearing Sergeant Wilson. When I went through the police academy, he was an old detective in homicides. And he would say, "Now let me give you a clue. It's not in the books. But if you see a homicide, there's a way to tell whether a woman did it or a man did it." And he says, "I've seen it over and over." He said, "Look at the gun if it's there. And if a man shot him, there'll be one bullet. If a woman shot him, it'll be all six bullets, and she will throw the gun at his head. Or if you find his head cut off and he's also shot, a woman did it." Now, I don't know whether that's true or not. I just passed that on. But in this particular context of thought, and it was one of the great fears of Israelites. They prayed about this. And one of the judgments that the prophets would announce is, you not only kill, but you feed the body to the birds. And you never bury the carcass. And in much Jewish mentality, that was the worst thing that could happen to you, would be for your death to be followed by this kind of dishonor and disdain. And so part of the punishment of an enemy is kill him till he's dead, and then chop him up and feed him to the birds. And that was part of the judgment that went with it. Let me show you that once in the prophets and once in the psalm. Look at Jeremiah 7:33. And Jeremiah wants to let them know how bad this judgment is going to be. So if Israel would come back from battle against Babylon and with a victory, the question would be of the Israelite people, did you feed them to the birds? I hope to heaven you didn't kill them and bury them. That's honorable. You bury them, I mean you kill them, and then you mutilate them. And that was part of their thinking. And I know it's not part of ours, but unfortunately the Old Testament wasn't as enlightened as we are, or nearly as kind. I'm smiling. Chapter 7, verse 33. Notice how Jeremiah wants to announce how horrible the judgment is going to be, and how does he do it? Well, you have the slaughter in the following preceding verses, but verse 33, the enemy is now dead. It says, "And the dead bodies of this people will be food for the birds of the sky and for the beasts of the earth, and no one will frighten them away." You not only kill them, but they're eaten by the birds of the sky and the beasts of the field. "Then I will make to cease from the cities of Judah and from the seats of Jerusalem the voice of joy and the voice of gladness, the voice of the bridegroom and the the voice of the bride, for the land will be a ruin. And so notice there is they're fed, literally fed to the demon. Go back to chapter 8, or over to chapter 8, it even goes further. At that time, declares the Lord, they will bring out the bones of the kings of Judah. This is when the guy's already dead and buried, but you want to do him more dishonor? We'll dig him up. So bring out the bones of the kings of Judah, the bones of the princes, the bones of the priests, the bones of the prophets, the bones of the inhabitants of Jerusalem from their graves, and they will spread them out to the sun, the moon, and all the host of heaven which they have loved and which they have served and which they have gone after and which they have sought and which they have worshipped. They will not be gathered or buried. They will be as dung on the face of the ground. So spread them like manure, and if they're in the grave, dig them up to dishonor them. So that was much the thought. Now, the thought of having your body fed to the beasts of the field and never given an honest burial was the subject of Psalm 79. Psalm 79. One through three. O God, the nations have invaded thine inheritance. They have defiled thy holy temple. They have laid Jerusalem in ruins. Obviously, the tone is one of despair over the judgment of God and how terrible it was. And notice how terrible it really was, verse 2. They have given the dead bodies of thy servants for food to the birds of the heavens. The flesh of thy godly ones to the beasts of the earth. They have poured out their blood like water round about Jerusalem, and there was no one to bury them. And what is the psalmist describing? The worst possible scenario. So, going back to 1 Samuel then, and here we'll find that David is going to conquer. And let's jot down some notes over his conquest. David now conquers. And notice he spells everything out in terms of a threefold contrast. Then David said, this is verse 45, to the Philistine, you come to me with a sword, a spear, and a javelin, but I come to you in the name of the Lord of hosts. So notice we have first a contrast of weapons. First thing that David says, we come to this battle with totally different weapons. Second, this day, verse 46, the Lord will deliver you into my hands, and I will strike you down and remove your head from you, and I will give the dead bodies of the army of the Philistines this day to the birds of the sky and the wild beasts of the earth, that all the earth may loathe there's a God in Israel. And so we have a contrast and who the victor is. Contrast and the victor. But there's more to it than that. Notice the latter part of verse 46. There is a complete contrast in purpose. The purpose of the victory of David is that all the earth may know that there is a God in Israel, and that all this assembly may know that the Lord does not deliver by sword or spear, for the battle is the Lord's, and he will give you into our hand. So notice the purpose is going to be God's glory is the bottom line. God's glory, David says, is the bottom line. And this battle is intended to impact everyone for the glory and the honor of God. Now, notice one other thing. As David talks about the weapons in verse 45, you might want to link two words together. And I find this very helpful. For example, in verse 43 in pencil, I've got the word gods circled. And I run that line down to verse 45, where David says, I come to you in the name of the Lord of hosts. And so in marking, I've got gods. Then down here, the name. Now, notice two sets of contrasts here. What's the first? Just do it grammatically now. What's the difference, at least one grammatical aspect, from gods and name? Singular, plural. Plural. Singular. The second contrast is the gods are unnamed. Just in the name of his gods. Well, who in the world are they? We don't know. They're unnamed. But the name of the God of Israel is named as Yahweh. The first set contrasts all of the ancient world with Israel. Israel knew a singular God who had a name. All the rest had gods. So the Philistine comes into the battle a polytheist. David comes into the battle a monotheist. The gods of Goliath, we don't know who they were. Oh, we can make guess. With Gath was up at Gath was Dagon, but the list goes on and on and on. Why? What is conveyed with the idea of name? Name tells something about yourself. So the gods of Philistia were man-made. The God of Israel was self-revealed. He told us what his name was, and what that name meant. And David says the major theological point of this whole battle is right here. I want the whole world to know that there's no one but Yahweh. And I want Israel to know it. I want you to know it. That he is the God of all gods. And so this is really the doctrinal heart of this little section here in this contest. So notice the victory comes about 48 through 54. Verse 49, David put his hand into his bag and took from it a stone and slung it. It struck the Philistine on the forehead, and the stone sank into his forehead so that he fell on his face to the ground. Then David prevailed over the Philistine with a sling and a stone. He killed him with that. And he struck the Philistine and killed him. So he's now dead. But what is the style of the warfare in Israel? You mean you're gonna just leave? You're not taking anything home? You don't take any trophies home? Well, it says, notice verse 50, the last sentence, there was no sword in David's hand. What does that reaffirm? That reaffirms verse 47, doesn't it? Verse 47 said the battle is the Lord's. Verse 50 says, now note, there was no sword in David's hand. Then David ran and stood over Philistine and took his sword and drew it out of his sheath and killed him and cut his head off with it. When the Philistines saw that their champion was dead, they fled. And so notice the scene is death followed by decapitation. You kill the enemy, you emaciate the enemy. And the idea involved that the victory of the sling and that was celebrated with disgrace and humiliation, or as we said, death followed by decapitation. Now, in the last 3 minutes, a couple of conclusions. Number one, when we come down to 1751 through 58, shows us the Philistines broke the agreement of verse 9. It shows the Philistines broke their word. And the word had been given by Goliath. And that is, if you beat us, we'll turn ourselves over to you. We will surrender. Remember verse 9, and let's pick up on it in conclusion. If he is able to fight with me and kill me, then we will become your servants. And as you notice in verse 51, David ran, stood over the Philistine, took his sword, drew it out of the sheath, and killed him. Cut his head off it. When the Philistines saw that their champion was dead, they surrendered. They fled and they fought all the way back. And they never stopped fighting. And as we said last time, I forget the military leader in Israel who from this passage derived a principle of battle for Israel. Never trust an enemy's treaty. And that's very realistic. I always think that Israel ought to be spelled I-S-R-E-A-L, Israel. And that was one of their principles discovered from Samuel, that that the word of the enemy is worthless. And they derive policy from this about great caution over believing what your enemy agrees to do. Now, chapter 18, and I just introduce it. Chapter 18 is another reminder that the life of David in relation to Saul was one of complete contrast. And so we will find with chapter 18 and verse 1, the most outstanding friendship anywhere in the Bible. It came about when he had finished speaking to Saul that the soul of Jonathan was knit to the soul of David. And Jonathan loved him as himself. And what we'll want to develop there is David and Jonathan, on one hand, will be a picture of the most faithful and permanent friendship in the Bible. On the other hand, there's the parallel story. And the parallel story that Saul stands as the most virulent enemy that David ever knew. So, the story from 18 on is a story of amity, A-M-I-T-Y, David and Jonathan, and enmity, David and Saul. Now, we'll find out in this section another, I think, very important lesson that sometimes Christians miss. As a physical being, man needs food and drink. As a spiritual meeting, man needs fellowship with God. And as human beings, everyone sitting in this room or anywhere needs friends. And we're going to ask in this following section, what is friendship? And our definition will come to chapter 18. It's a soul relationship. It is a soul relationship because two souls were bound together. It does not say that Jonathan was knit to David. The soul of Jonathan was knit to the soul of David. What is friendship coming from that? What initiates it? What are the expressions of it? And how are its qualities expressed both in the life of Jonathan and David as this follows? Remember, the life of David is a life that has to be studied in connection with others. Friendship in connection with Jonathan. Enemy in connection with Saul. But that's the way it's put together, and that is of tremendous, tremendous importance. I believe when we complete our study on friendship that you will conclude that if you have three friends in life, you are a very, very fortunate person. We're thankful for this great man, David, that you set in front of us. We're thankful that the same man who is a hero here, that your word is so honest, you don't hide the faults of any of your characters or any of your children. And when David falls into sin, he will be as exposed there as he is here to the glory of defeating the Philistines. And therefore, we're thankful for the honesty of your word. May we be just as honest with ourselves and with you in Christ's name. Amen.